Committee of the Joint Ways and Means Committee, and we're meeting today to discuss the budget of the Department of, or the Office of Energy, rather. And I'll start the meeting out today with Legislative Fiscal Officer Sue McGlashan to explain to us about the Office of Energy budget.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members of the subcommittee, you've got a number of handouts in front of you. Of course, the governor's recommended budget document in the binder, and then some loose handouts, which I'll briefly explain and then go over one set in a little more detail from the Legislative Fiscal Office. First, you have a copy of the bill. This is Senate Bill 5515, the budget bill for the Office of Energy. And you also have a handout from the Legislative Fiscal Office. Has a textual document on the front, just so you can identify that. There's also a handout from the Office of Energy. They'll be going through that when they do their presentation. And finally, there's a handout from the Department of Administrative Services Budget and Management Division. Looks like this. And they'll be going through that one when they do their presentation. So if you would turn your attention to the Legislative Fiscal Office handouts, I'll briefly go over those just to give you some orientation and background on this agency. Under the agency role, budget size, and budget drivers, I've indicated there to see the attached handouts. And what you've got behind this document is a page that has some slides on it. And that basically gives you a snapshot of what the agency does. And then if you turn it over, you'll see the agency's budget and revenue sources. And in the 2001-03 governor's recommended budget, it's $165.9 million total funds and 77.94 FTE. Shows you in that pie chart the breakout of the different types of funds. And then down below, there's a slide that shows you a couple of the major budget drivers for this agency in 2001-03. And then behind that document is the Office of Energy's analysis from our published document that we put out at the beginning of each legislative session. And it gives you a bit more detail on the different program areas in the office and goes through the revenue sources and relationships, budget environment and performance measures, and then what's in the governor's budget for this agency. Just briefly, in terms of the agency's revenue sources, this is an agency that's supported almost entirely by other funds and federal funds. There's a small bit of general fund, and that'll be discussed in more detail as we get into the presentation. That's basically financial support for the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry, and that has been going on for a couple of biennia, and the governor's proposed budget would continue that funding, although at a slightly lower level than has occurred in the past. So basically, the primary revenue sources for this agency are other funds, and those come primarily through fees paid by users of the programs that the agency operates, and also some assessments that are set in statute. And then federal funds come from a few different sources: the U.S. Department of Energy, the Bonneville Power Administration, and the Federal Highway Administration, to name a few. And there, of course, is a revenue tab in the budget document if you want more detail about those, the various sources of revenues that support this budget. We are also supposed to discuss with you any budget notes from the prior legislative session. There was one, and that had to do with the financial support for OMSI. And basically what the Office of Energy was supposed to do was come and report on the financial status of OMSI, and at the same time, if necessary, request allocation of a special purpose appropriation that was established in the emergency fund should OMSI need the financial support. And in fact, the emergency board did allocate all of those funds during the 99-01, biennium, and that was a total of $1.425 million. We're also supposed to discuss with you any audit reports, and there were a couple, but they had no significant findings, so I didn't provide any copies of those reports for you, but if you do want copies, we can always make those available. There were no interim reports or studies, or and there are no fee adjustments in this budget. There were no significant policy or oversight issues considered by the emergency board or any interim committees. And then finally, the last issue or item that we were supposed to bring to your attention would be any relevant issues, trends, or special challenges. Of course, with this agency, that would entail rising energy costs and the ability of the agency to respond to issues, for example, involving increased awareness of and interest in energy conservation, renewable resources, and even siting of new energy facilities and other programs that this agency operates. Another relevant issue would be electricity industry restructuring under Senate Bill 1149, and this agency does have a role in that legislation, and they'll get into that more when they do their presentation. And then finally, the last issue is one that I've already mentioned, and that would be continuation of the financial support to OMSI. So with that, that's in brief the background and the orientation on this budget, and we would ask then that the Executive Director of the Office of Energy do the presentation for their budget.
Mr. Savage, please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Savage. I'm the Administrator of the Office of Energy. As Sue mentioned, we have a handout that's a very short description that will track my presentation. Before I get to the budget numbers, I'd like to describe what we do and provide a little context for our work. Energy plays a huge role in our economy, and I think that's never more apparent than when supplies are tight and energy prices are rising. We all depend on it. Altogether, we spend nearly $6 billion a year on energy. I think beyond those dollars, producing and using energy also imposes cost on our environment and on our quality of life. And in essence, our job is to minimize those costs. And we do that through our work in four areas. One is encouraging people and businesses to invest in energy conservation. Two is siting new power plants and other energy facilities. Three is promoting the development of new energy resources and technologies. And four is protecting Oregonians from the hazards of radioactive waste. And I'd like to talk about that last program area first. We're Oregon's leads for seeing to it that nuclear waste are cleaned up, stored, and transported safely. And we're also responsible for the state's emergency preparedness in the event of an accident. For the most part, we're concerned with high-level radioactive waste. So these are the wastes at two sites: Trojan Nuclear Power Plant in Columbia County and Hanford Reservation in Washington State. Trojan. When Trojan was running, we were responsible for its safe operation. Now we're responsible for its safe dismantling. Trojan's been closed for 8 years. We think there's about three more years to go to clean up the site. The last major part of the process is storing the spent fuel rods. They are now in water basins near the reactor, and we approved a plan by PGE to store them in 34 100-ton concrete cast near the site. And right now, PGE is assessing those containers to house the rods, and we expect they'll be moved in 18 to 36 months. The site we worry about the most is Hanford. Oregon has a huge stake in Hanford cleanup. It is on the Columbia River, and it's 35 miles from Oregon's border. It is without doubt the most dangerous site in the United States because most of the waste there are stored unsafely. The more dangerous liquid waste are stored in huge underground storage tanks, many of which are leaking. There are more than 2,000 tons of reactor fuel in two concrete pools of water that are deteriorating. And billions of gallons of waste dumped into the ground now contaminate the groundwater, which feeds into the Columbia River. As you can imagine, the cleanup of Hanford will be is highly complex, And it will take the U.S. Department of Energy, which is responsible for that, decades to do it. The Hanford Waste Board, which is a 20-member board created by the legislature, guides Oregon's efforts in the cleanup. Senator Farioli sits on that board. We staff that board, and our fundamental role is to ensure that Oregon's interests are considered in any decision that would affect the health and well-being of Oregonians. To give you an idea of what we do, let me give two examples. One, we did an analysis that showed that the water basins holding the reactor fuel would crumble during an earthquake. The water would drain, the fuel would catch on fire, and it would release this massive plume of radioactivity. Our work prompted the United States Department of Energy to shore up the water basins and also to speed up the timetable for placing it in safer storage. And this December, they moved the first of the rods to a safer storage facility some 5 miles away from the river. Second example, we're responsible for safe transport of radioactive material through Oregon and that we're prepared should an accident occur. Wastes are transported daily across Oregon to and from their way to Hanford. And those shipments are going to increase. The Department of Energy launched a campaign recently in which it's going to be shipping plutonium-contaminated trash, such as clothes and lab equipment, across Oregon to a disposal site in New Mexico. And there will be about 2,500 shipments in all. We spearhead the development of a detailed plan for the safe transport of those shipments that the U.S. Department of Energy adopted. And this binding, we also trained more than 600 local emergency response staff, such as fire and police and hospital staff, along the transport route. And we also conducted three exercises in La Grande, Baker City, and Ontario to prepare sort of a simulation of disaster exercises. Last, the Oregonians bear significant risks from Hanford, but we have no legal say in the cleanup of Hanford. One of our priorities, we've made significant difference there, but ultimately our role is advisory. So one of our priorities is to get congressional approval to give Oregon a decision-making role at Hanford. We have two measures of success for our nuclear waste work. One is that it results in actions that do not in any way jeopardize the health of Oregonians, our environment, or the Columbia River. And we've had some recent successes here this biennium. Two, that we're prepared to respond quickly and effectively if there's an accident, either at Hanford or in transport. We've developed response plans that we test several times of year under simulated disaster conditions. Our goal is a perfect grade from FEMA, the Federal Energy Management Agency, and we've gotten that since 1996. Second program area is siting energy facilities. Since 1975 in Oregon, there's been a central siting authority, the Energy Facility Siting Council, that decides whether large energy facilities can be built in the state of Oregon. Those facilities include power plants with a capacity greater than 25 megawatts, high voltage power lines, major interstate natural gas and pipelines. We staff the council. And one of our primary roles is to evaluate proposals against a set of performance standards, about a dozen in all, that are designed to protect Oregon, important Oregon resources, and the public health and safety. I know there's a lot of interest in energy facility siting given the current energy environment, so I'd like to talk about a few features of the state siting process. One, it is a one-stop form. All necessary state and local licenses, permits, and approvals are decided within the siting process. I think that's unique to the state of Oregon. Two, there's a set time for review and decision once the final application is filed by an applicant. That's 6 months for small facilities, or 9 or 12 months for larger facilities. Three, there are exemptions from state approval for low-impact facilities, such as high-efficiency cogeneration plant at industrial sites. I'll be talking about cogeneration plants. So these are plants that use, in which the steam is not only used to produce electricity, but it's also used for, in processing of a manufactured product. So you get a two-for-one out of the generating, using the, burning the fuel. And so it's very, very efficient way of generating electricity. The fourth is that there's ample input for, opportunity for public input. Since 1994, the Energy Facility Siting Council has licensed one natural gas pipeline and six power plants. Two of those have been built. Three are under construction today, one in Klamath Falls, one near Hermiston, and one near Boardman. And their combined capacity is about 1,300 megawatts. For comparison to what a megawatt is, for 1,000 megawatts is about would it be enough to serve a city the size of Seattle. So 1,300 megawatts is a substantial amount of electricity. As you can expect, there's a lot of interest in development today. We are reviewing proposals for another natural gas pipeline and three more power plants. The natural gas pipeline is a pipeline that's being planned by Northwest Natural. It's a 60-mile gas pipeline that starts in southern Columbia County, will go through Sherwood to Molalla in Clackamas County. These three power plants are one, a 99-megawatt wind power plant in northern Umatilla County, a 550-megawatt natural gas-fired power plant near Hermiston, and a 980-megawatt natural gas-fired power plant in Jefferson County. To boot, we expect about two to four more applications for power plants this spring. One of our efficiency measures is that once the final application is filed, that we produce a draft decision document within 60% of the time allowed under law, that we are actually faster than the time allowed under law, and on our most recent siting application, we were.
Mr. Savage?
Yes.
By one-stop permitting, does that mean that in order to site a power generation facility, you don't have to go, for example, through local land use planning regulations and that kind of thing? Does it actually take care of all the permitting requirements?
Madam Chair, yes. With local siting land use, it's actually done within our process. And that a developer has two different ways of getting a local a land use approval, one of which would include that they can ask the Energy Facility Siting Council to make the decision, but it does it through an extensive review with local regulators.
Is there another federal layer of regulation on top of what the state requires?
Federal regulation that sort of overlays in that we try to do at the same time as air quality permit. That is a federally delegated permit, and so we work with DEQ. So then actually we try to do that in parallel with all the other licenses and approvals and permits.
So is it fair to say then that when a generation facility is through Oregon's permitting process, it's also through the federal process?
Yes.
The other question I had was, we've been told that the transmission system is somewhat near capacity. Is that something that your department oversees?
Yes. We're responsible for high-voltage power lines that exceed 230 kilovolts or more, which are among the biggest possible ones that you see out there. I think they have to be 10 miles in length and cross two jurisdictions. If they meet those criteria, then they do come under the Energy Facility Siting Council's review. One exception is one of our major power plant power line owners and developers here in the region is Bonneville Power Administration. Federal agencies are exempt.
So can you talk to us about any new transmission capacity that's planned?
As far as I know, Madam Chair, is most of the transmission, most of it is what I would call it upgrades of existing lines through use of some sophisticated devices, as opposed to, I'm not aware of any absolute new lines that are other than big lines, other than maybe some small lines that are probably planned I know one of the areas right now of great concern to in the Northwest is whether or not there's adequate transmission to go into to the Puget Sound area. And so Bonneville's undertaking a major study right at this moment to take a look at options for ensuring that they can get a reliable flow of power into the Puget Sound area. But I'm not aware of any development. Yeah, very little right at the moment.
The wind power facility that is in the works for up on the gorge, my understanding is that the problem with wind power is that you can't store the energy. And so unless you have a real consistent wind supply, you can't really tailor the generation to the demand. How are they going to deal with that?
One of the backup, in a sense, to smooth it out is the use of you can either use a natural gas fired power plant. In fact, I know of some developments that are occurring that it's sort of they're trying to actually meld the wind power with the natural gas fired power so they get the optimum economic amount of power out at any time through in a new development.
Representative Krieger.
John, where does FERC come into this as far as the regulatory thing on something that's going to be built in Oregon and the environmental impact statements and all those type of things that involve the timeline if you wanted to do anything? Isn't it a pretty horrible situation as far as permitting?
Anything that comes under FERC regulation is not regulated by us. That's probably the clearest distinction right now. So, for example, if there's interstate pipelines, that would come under the FERC, which is the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. This is a commission that basically regulates wholesale markets. This is the markets for the generation and delivery of electricity and natural gas to our utilities, who then in turn sell to us. So for the Federal Energy Regulatory, or FERC, we don't overlap because it's either their jurisdiction or it's going to come under the state jurisdiction. So, for example, for a big pipeline that would be across multiple states, we would not have a jurisdiction over that.
I did a small hydro plant years ago and had to get an exemption from FERC. I think I got the second one done at that time. How come I had to deal with them then? On a small plant, if it was in state,
I think hydropower relicensing. David, is that hydropower relicensing comes under the Federal Energy Regulatory?
That is another area for jurisdiction.
Okay. One. I should mention two things. One thing is that hydropower relicensing does not come under the Energy Facility Siting Council jurisdiction. It does come under the Federal Energy Regulatory. So that the issues about there's very big issues now with the relicensing of hydroelectric power plants, those are coming under the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And so that's, they have their own processes and everything like that to deal with it.
On the applications, you must have to get sign-off from U.S. Fish and Wildlife and the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and the National Marine Fisheries Service.
Department of State. Division of State Lands, so there's a number of agencies that we do.
Okay. And so the federal agencies that are outside of the normal energy regulatory process, are they coordinated into the permitting process also?
A big one, is typically many of these plants require a federal environmental impact statement, and those environmental impact statements are done by the Bonneville Power Administration for the most part. So anytime anything crosses any federal line or has a federal impact of any, then it requires an environmental impact. One of the things that we have a memorandum of agreement with the Bonneville Power Administration, which we try to track, get there, so that while we're doing our review, that we're not trying to double up on the amount of time that a developer has to take, you know, that then they have to wait for an environmental impact statement. So we try to mesh our two reviews.
Please proceed.
Okay. Well, let me talk about our fourth program area, and that's developing new resources. And what we usually mean by new resources are ones that are renewable, such as wind, solar, and geothermal. But we also promote what I would call clean alternative technologies, such as high-efficiency cogeneration or fuel cells and alternative fuels for vehicles. our aim is to remove barriers to development and to bring down their cost. And we do that in two ways. One, by providing technical help and financing for projects where there are power plants or home heating devices. We also research and demonstrate new technologies and applications as they come along. Today, as you'd anticipate, we're working with many firms, developers, ranchers, and agencies on planned projects that range from cogeneration, wind power plants, to solar electricity systems. I'd like to highlight two of our current projects. One is a proposed ethanol plant near Clatskanie. This is the proposal by a company called Cascade Grain Products, and they have come to us for a loan, and they're proposing to build a plant that would produce 80 million gallons a year of ethanol. That would be, if built, this is ethanol is used as sort of a cleaner burning gasoline additive, and if built, this would be the first alternative fuel plant in Oregon. Second example of a project that we're working with is an example of a niche market where we sort of tap a cost-effective application. And this is we're funding a project in Morrow County to turn cow manure into electricity. And as you may be aware, Tillamook Creamery is planning to build a processing plant in Morrow County. And three dairies with 21,000 cows will provide the milk. And so that the manure, what we're funding is a project that would that the manure could be converted in a digester to methane gas and other byproducts. And then the methane is going to be burned to generate electricity, fairly cheap, very reliable power. Last program area, and that's energy conservation. Conservation's long been a cornerstone of Oregon's energy policy because it's the cheapest and cleanest way of meeting our energy needs. The opportunities to become energy efficient come virtually from every home, every business, every industrial plants in the state. And to tap those opportunities, we provide information to consumers on ways to save energy. We demonstrate new energy saving technologies, and we offer a variety of programs to encourage homes and businesses to invest in energy conservation. And in all, we run about 20 programs to do that. As of year-end 1999, our programs have saved enough energy to serve a city roughly the size of Salem. It's for electricity alone, it's saved enough electricity to eliminate the need for two power plants of the size being built today. And all told, the Oregonians who have invested in conservation through one of our programs have cut their energy bills by $250 million a year. I'd like to describe our two main incentive programs, Business Energy Tax Credit and the Small Scale Energy Loan Program. First, the Business Energy Tax Credit. The purpose of the credit is to encourage businesses to invest in energy conservation, renewable resources, and recycling. Credit is for 35% of the cost of investment taken over 5 years. Since 1980, more than 5,500 credits have been awarded, and the businesses run the gamut from grocery stores to sawmills to food processors to rental housing owners to farms and ranches to just anything that you can, pretty much any kind of business that you can imagine throughout the state. And all told, those people who have invested through one of our programs, those businesses have cut their bills by about $100 million a year. The tax credit has proven to be an effective vehicle to advance leading-edge technologies, to develop markets for recycled materials, and also to stimulate projects where market barriers hinder progress, such as rental housing. I'd like to give you one illustration before I go to our loan program, and that's a company called Consolidated Metco in Clackamas County. They make aluminum molds for car trucks, for trucks and trailer parts, and they use a lot of natural gas to melt the aluminum. And recently, with one of our tax credits, they installed a new melting furnace that's actually pretty rare here in the United States that reduces their natural gas use by 60%. And it's been so successful, they plan to install a second one. Second main incentive program is the small-scale energy loan program. Through it, we offer low-interest, long-term loans for energy conservation and renewable resource projects. To date, 528 loans have been made for about $300 million for a broad range of projects, and they include power plants that generate electricity from landfill gas and wood waste, energy-efficient irrigation systems, or efficient lighting and heating upgrades in school buildings or commercial buildings. One recent example is we provided a loan to the RTJ building, which is along I-5 near Portland, and it's a showcase of energy-efficient technologies and features. For example, it was designed to maximize the use of daylighting, so rather than artificial lighting, you'd have natural daylighting come in. Solar electricity helps light the parking lot. It has a highly energy-efficient heating, ventilation, and air conditioning system. All in all, it uses about 25% less energy than if it had been built to code. Those are our two main incentive programs, and I'd like to highlight one other area, and that's our work with schools. We've long targeted schools for two reasons. One, there's a lot of energy saving potential in schools, but also obviously saving dollars there can better be used for students and education. Altogether, through our work with schools, we estimate that they've cut their bills by about $30 million a year. We offer energy audits. We offer financing for energy-efficient measures and equipment and training for building operators on how to operate and maintain equipment efficiently. One example here recently is work with the Jefferson County Middle School. Their new heating and cooling control system wasn't working. The classes were uncomfortable. It was poorly ventilated, so they had to shut it off and do all this manually, which was keeping their energy bills quite high. So one of our analysts took a look at the equipment. They found that the automatic controls had been set wrong when it was installed. So we went in and fixed it, and right now they're saving $10,000 a year on their energy bills. One of our priorities for the next biennium is successful implementation of a new school energy conservation program that's provided under Senate Bill 1149, Oregon's new electric restructuring law. As you're probably aware, Senate Bill 1149 introduces competition into the retail electricity markets of PGE, Portland General Electric, and Pacific. And that law requires that certain public purposes be funded, and one of those public purposes is energy conservation in schools. And they'll be receiving about $5 million a year under the bill. This biennium, we worked with school districts and education service districts and other to help design an approach to maximize the dollars that are going for cost-saving projects. For our work in conservation renewables, we have four measures of success. One, if the state's investments in new projects each year yield substantial savings. Two, if an appropriate number of incentives go to new and innovative technologies as well as hard-to-reach markets such as rental housing. Three is if program recipients rate our services as very good. And four, if no more than 5% of our program costs go for administration. That's kind of my overview. I can go into our organization and budget now. That's kind of my overview of who we are and what we do and why we do it. So if there's any questions.
Any questions? Representative Krieger.
You talked about the ethanol class. Can I hear the source?
It's mostly right now is Midwest corn, unfortunately. One of the things that we would like to do is see if we can sort of have a facility in which we could have local biomass
yeah,
as
that's
the
what
source.
I was wondering.
Right now they are going to be shipping, it will be shipped in for, so it will be primarily corn.
Come in by rail?
Yes.
Well, that was short and sweet.
Well, if I can continue. Just finish up that. Let me touch on how we're organized in our proposed budget. I guess this is short and sweet. Today, in your packet, there is a... we provided sort of an organization chart for the agency, and let me touch on that real briefly. The office has about 78 FTE today. That includes the two Oregon members of the Northwest Power Planning Council. Their salaries and budget travel have been in our budget since 1993. We staff two boards, the Energy Facilities Siting Council and the Hanford Waste Board, which I've mentioned. We have five divisions and the administrative office. They are the Conservation Division, which runs the lion's share of our conservation programs, the Energy Loan Division, which runs the small-scale energy loan program, the Energy Resources Division, which is responsible for siting energy facilities, regulating Trojan, and also researching and demonstrating new energy resource technologies. The Nuclear Safety Division is responsible for our Hanford work, for emergency preparedness, and for our transportation safety work. And we also have the Central Services Division. This includes public information personnel in our administrative work related to budget, grants and contracts, computer services, records management, equipment, mail, telephone, and reception. Over the past 10 years, been four major changes to this structure. First, the State Service Center for Geographic Information Systems, or GIS, which originated in our office, was transferred in 1995 to the Department of Administrative Services. That reduced our total staff by 8 FTE. Second, when the Trojan Nuclear Power Plant was operating, we had 3.5 FTE devoted to Trojan oversight. Now that it's closed, we have about a half FTE devoted to decommissioning and dismantling of Trojan. Three, before 1997, the Energy Resources and Nuclear Safety Division had been combined into one division, and now they're split apart. And fourth, between 1995 and 1999, we were a division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and now we're not. Affirmative action report, we've included a summary there. As of January 1, the office employed 71 employees, including 23 women, 5 persons of colors, and 4 persons with disabilities. Achieving parity with the workforce would require that we add 3 women, 2 persons of color, and 1 person with disabilities in administrative level and professional level jobs. This biennium, we made gains by adding 1 woman and 3 persons with disabilities to our staff. One of our long-runs approaches to achieving parity is to increase recruits for open positions by getting young people interested in the energy field. In this biennium, we had 2 internships, provided internships for 2 future individuals, absolutely delightful people who did valuable work for us, and we plan to continue this and hopefully expand it. I think in addition to our current recruitment activities, we'll use the web even more for recruits. We're going to be working with targeted engineering organizations and other community organizations, as well as expand the use of job rotations. Kind of an overview of how we are organized. It pretty much aligns with our functions right at the moment.
Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry, I'd like to go back to what is the role of the Energy Office and the nuclear waste disposal, especially as it relates to Hemiston and that area. I know there's been federal agencies and state agencies that have been working on the preparedness for that community as long as I've been a legislator, and probably a lot longer than that. The last I heard was there was really no clear direction as to what agency, be it state or federal, really was in charge of setting up that standard so that those citizens feel safe if there's an accident in that area.
This is for the nerve gas?
That's correct.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Representative Bowman, that's under the DEQ, Department of Environmental Quality. We're responsible for radioactive materials. They're responsible for hazardous materials.
I thought I heard you say, though, you were responsible for the readiness of that community.
For radioactive. But we do try to coordinate, Representative Bowman, we do try to coordinate with many of the people that we're training are the hazardous material responders.
And do you know if the coordination is any better than it was 2 years ago when I asked that question? I didn't ask you, but I asked someone that question 2 years ago.
I hope so. I don't. I certainly hope so.
Of course it is.
Yeah.
I don't know.
The training you were speaking of was relative to transporting radioactive material from Hanford to Nevada.
Right. There's actually two types of there's two types of accidents that we prepare for. One is an accident at Hanford, in which case that would affect primarily Morrow and Umatilla counties. If there was a plume, they were within the 50-mile radius for an accident for an airborne contamination. You plan for a 50-mile radius, and those counties come under that 50-mile radius. And so that we do emergency planning for that kind of event. We also do emergency preparedness planning for an event of in transport. You know, the big truck falls over and the cast breaks open. I mean, that's not quite how it happens, but so we also do that kind of training with the local emergency. And they all tend to be in the same area because the shipments of radioactive waste are along I-84. They come down on I-82 and they go on I-84 and they go out in Ontario.
So all of that material is going to be transported on truck?
Yes.
Thank you. Further questions? Senator Dukes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at a page, it's expenditure projections by source, and I was wondering, the other funds, could you run through what kind of funds? You've got conservation program, regulatory siting, small-scale energy loan, Northwest Power Planning Council, et cetera. I was just curious as to what they are. They're not federal and they're not general, as to what they were.
For other funds, are there funds? We receive about funds from about 60 different sources. And they include, so our other funds could include contracts. For example, there is an organization called the Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance. And in a sense, before we used to receive money from the Bonneville Power Administration for energy conservation programs, we are no longer funded by that, but we are funded by a regional energy conservation program, this alliance program. So for example, individual conservation projects we do would show up, we receive funding from them for individual conservation projects. We have a number of different kinds of fees. For example, for our small-scale energy loan program, which is included in the other funds category. It's completely self-sustaining so that the users of the program, the people who invest in the projects and have to make the loan payments include some portion, a very small portion of administrative costs for our programs, and that's included in that. We also, for example, for the Business Energy Tax Credit Program, we receive fees from the program participants to review those projects. Under the Transport Safety Program, there's a very small fee on all shipments of radioactive waste for the state, which we then use for our emergency preparedness training. So that's just giving a sort of a sampling of the types of, but it falls into those. There's also an assessment that is done on energy suppliers, a very tiny assessment that then is used for general work in the agency.
And the Power Planning Council?
Power Planning Council is just stuffed in our budget. I mean, they're the. let me. Since they are officially considered state employees, and so that they have to be some, their salaries and travel have to be somewhere, so they're included in our budget. They're funded from Bonneville Power Administration. So that does not show up as a, for us it's an other fund, but it's actually a federal funded positions.
So Bonneville sends the money to the state and then the state issues the check.
Right. Okay. So those are some of the examples of our other funds.
Thank you.
Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. As a member of the committee, I think the toughest days I've ever spent as a legislator were the first 3 days of orientation to the Hanford waste issues. And I'm talking about a headache that lasted for a couple of days after the meeting. And it's a real emotional experience to see how this country's commitment to national defense over the years turn the Hanford Nuclear Reservation into the most polluted spot in the Western Hemisphere. And that's no exaggeration. I think every member of the committee ought to get a copy of the briefing book that the committee members, the Hanford Oregon Waste Cleanup Board members, get to orient them to the issues. It's probably, I don't know, 180 pages or so. And, you know, every page is a bigger horror than the previous page. By the time you get through it all, you just can't get your mind around it. It takes you a while. You have to keep going back. For instance, billions of gallons of water used for cooling the core of nuclear reactors were run untreated into the river. Now, you can understand how that would be an operational necessity in 1941 and 2 and 3. You know, when the facilities were being put online and built. You can even understand through the Cold War, as the knowledge of radioactivity and its effects on, people and environmental issues and ecosystems was being pieced together in field tests and also in the environment. Maybe you'll have less sympathy for the idea of intentional discharges of radioactive gases to track, plumes and to find out what accidental and intentional discharges or even a nuclear attack on this country would produce in terms of casualties, because that was a civil defense experiments that were done. But what you can understand is why we were still doing a lot of those things as late as 1973. So those are just some of the issues that will take you a little time to get your mind around. And I've come to have a great deal of appreciation for the Department of Energy's role in educating Oregonians about the threat, about the cleanup costs, about what's really out there, so far as is known. And interestingly, the documents that we request and routinely receive from the federal agencies that have managed out there are still subject to the security censorship. And so sometimes you do get documents that still have black lines lining out, fairly significant passages of information. And only some of it's now been declassified. I'm not even sure how many decades forward we've come to declassification, but there's a lot more unknown that is at Hanford than is known. And the price tag, just since I've been on the committee, which I think less than a year, has gone up by orders of magnitudes of billions for stabilization and cleanup. And every time I hear the number estimated, it's on the order of many more billions. So there's no question in my mind it's the largest single issue in our lifetimes, maybe the largest issue in the Northern Hemisphere for cleanup. It certainly is the biggest nuclear mess in the Western Hemisphere. So however you want to quarter the globe, we've got the mess right in our backyard. And
it's ours.
If you have not had an opportunity to see the briefing book, I think it'd be a great read. You don't need to read any scary novels. Just looking at what we know of the truth is enough to scare you to death.
Scary enough.
So the question and the challenge, I think, for Oregonians is this. We're not, we did not sign the tri-party agreement, which is Washington State, the Department of Defense, I think, and the Department of Energy. Is that the?
Environmental Protection Agency.
EPA. Because we were already assumed not to have a direct
impact,
standings. That kind of thing. But clearly, we're in the airshed. Our waters touch the state of Washington. Pollution is directly attributable. If there's an accident there or a meltdown or some other untoward thing, it will certainly affect the whole Columbia River corridor. So certainly we have, even though we're not signatories, I think we probably do have standing. We're having it researched. But the plants and the facilities were built literally when this country was at war. They were maintained and continued under a rubric of the moral equivalency of war. We just can't seem to get anybody to take that kind of approach when it comes to cleanup. Mm-hmm. And it ought to be that kind of an approach, because of the 177 steel containers out there, half were built from 1940 to 1960, and half of them are single wall construction. They had a half life of 40 years when they were built. You know, we've only just started to put some kind of tracking mechanism to find out what's in the tanks, because they're interconnected in tank farms of a dozen, 10 to a dozen. And when one would heat up and start to bubble, well, we'd just run it into one of the other ones that might have been less full. So now we're not really sure what's in any of these tanks. It's like kids playing with one of those home chemistry sets, only the stuff was all caustic, poisonous, and radioactive. Half of the tanks are leaking. Stuff is going into the Columbia River now, despite some rather heroic efforts at putting in underground barriers to the flow. It's getting into the river. And the newest hazard, again, that's been identified, we just heard about, and that's potential seismic releases and potential meltdown if the cooling waters in these two tanks, which are right hard by the Columbia River, are lost because of an earthquake, and what happens to this nuclear soup that's at the bottom of these pools. What's happened is over the years the rods have started to corrode, and they've released spent nuclear fuel into about a 10-foot black zone that's made up of corroded metal, rust, and highly radioactive materials. That's a nuclear soup you just don't want to see out in the world. And so we've just begun the process of getting that stuff away from the river, and it'll be decades before it's all cleaned up. That's on a fast track. And so I guess that gives you some idea of the frustration people feel on this committee. And Oregon has no other authority than moral suasion. You know, we're not part of the tri-party agreement. You know, we can stand and plead for justice, but we can't claim the law. The facility itself is beyond the reach of normal environmental laws.
Should we be thinking about suing the federal government or somebody?
Yeah,
get standing.
Yeah, I think that may be the next step. But the fact of the matter is, there's an open question about whether we have standing to sue. So we're trying to have that research. Anyway, I just thought I'd brighten your day. It's the first day of the fourth week of the legislative session, and I have a feeling that all previous legislative sessions, at some point in time, a committee like this one listened to honorable folks from the state agency charged with the management of the problem, and at least from an informational standpoint, we're charged with the management of the problem. And they laid this issue before the legislature, and it's been happening now since 1945, since the end of the war, and it's been a good while. We still don't seem to have very much progress behind it.
Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to go back to something you said earlier about working with various school districts to do energy efficiency programs. How do you make the decision to determine what school districts you'll work with, and is there a charge from your agency to those school districts for the service that you provide?
Madam Chair, Representative Bowman, there's no charge. Typically, when we provide energy audits, it's free. I mean, and our services that we provide, if they come through, for example, our loan program and seek financing, like a low interest loan, there is a small charge that's added to receive the loan. One of the things that we've been doing, there is no real, it's kind of not first come, first serve. We'll work with anybody that'll come to us. Number one, I think that's my first answer to the question. At the same time, what we've been targeting schools that have abnormally high energy bills. You know, we figure that those are the school districts or schools that might be having more problems. That there's something going on there that's driving up their energy bills far more, you know, than typical. So over one of our activities has been sort of this. We have a staffer who sort of goes out, troubleshoots. Like it was an example I was using of the Jefferson County Middle School. You know, for those school districts and schools where they're just facing very abnormally high bills, and there's something seriously wrong.
If I may, Madam Chair, how do you find out that they have these high energy bills?
They call us.
So they call you.
They call
and
us.
So
yeah.
That's how you get into the loop.
Now, at the same time, we also try to get information about our services and programs. And we go out and we make presentations to school districts. We make presentations. We try to get our information about our services and programs out to them. I mean, so that will, you know, in a sense, prompt the call.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Well, let me do a sort of an overview of our proposed budget. What we do. I talked about our organization, how we're organized. Now I'd like to talk about our proposed budget. The governor's proposed operating budget for the office for 2001-2003 is $23.3 million. That's about $700,000 more than the 1999-2001 operating budget of $22.6 million, a 3% increase. Our proposed staffing level is 78 in FTE, which is the same as it is today. The increase in budget comes from three sources. One, we're requesting an additional $158,906 in an enhancement package, which I'll talk about. For new work required under Senate Bill 1149, Oregon's electric restructuring law. Two, there's an increase in personal service expenses due to the expected step increases for salaries for staff. We're not at top of step. This is a standard adjustment that's done for all agencies. And the third is a 2.5% increase in the services and supply category for general inflation. So those are the three main reasons there's a small increase in our budget. Funding sources. Senator Duke asked about our other funds. We're primarily funded from a mix of federal funds and other funds. And as I mentioned, we receive funds from about nearly 60 different sources. Our federal funds come predominantly from the United States Department of Energy. The bulk of those funds go for energy conservation and renewable resource programs, and the rest goes for our Hanford cleanup work. Our other category of fund consists of contracts, which I mentioned, assessments, and fees to various user groups to fund our other programs. We are proposing no increase in charge rates, fees, or assessments. Where our dollars go, about 71% of our proposed operating budget goes for programs and activities to achieve energy conservation. That's including administrative overhead. About 16% of our budget goes for energy facility siting, research and analysis, and the two Oregon members of the Northwest Power Planning Council. About 9% goes for our radioactive waste work, cleanup of Hanford, transport safety, and about 4% goes for our work to develop new resources and technologies. One other thing I like to highlight about our expenditures, about 40% of our budget goes out the door. It's funneled through the agencies to other entities, primarily for direct payments to program users and for professional contracts with private firms to provide direct services to the public. So, for example, we run a program called the State Home Oil Weatherization Program, and we provide, under that program, there are free energy audits that are provided to those homes. Those audits are done by a private firm.
Under the nuclear waste cleanup piece of the pie here, there's an item, Lakeview Mines. What's that?
Well, we're also responsible for, I said we are, for the most part, we're concerned with high-level radioactive waste, but we're concerned with all radioactive waste. And right now, there was some uranium mining that was done in the Lakeview area back in the late 50s, early 60s. And we are spearheading the work to get that cleaned up. It was abandoned. We want to get that cleaned up. It is a Superfund. We got it to become a Superfund site. And so we're working with the Environmental Protection Agency to get the party Kerr-McGee to begin cleanup of that. And right now we just won a court case saying that our approach and our authority applies to those sites, to those two uranium mine sites, on current course we should have that cleaned up and away from floodplains, which is our biggest concern, that sometime in 2002.
Madam Chair. Representative Bowman.
Thank you. Can you tell me what is the Industrial Conservation Certification Program that's, I think, a new item in your budget that's almost $159,000?
Yeah, this is one of our two enhancement packages, Representative Bowman.
So is that the staff position?
That is a staff, and it includes a staff position, one. Under Senate Bill 11, this is to implement a new industrial energy conservation program that's required under Senate Bill 1149. That bill requires that certain, there's a customer charge and that certain public purposes be funded. It also has a provision that allows large electricity users to use a part of their charge for their own investments in conservation and renewable resources. And we're responsible for implementing that part of the new law. So what this person will do would be to conduct and review energy audits, to certify eligible companies that they meet. There's a standard there for who can participate in this program. This person would approve and reprove, approve and review and approve projects that are conservation projects done by the firms. They would monitor expenditures and also produce a yearly report that all funders are required to do under that bill to the legislature. We expect that there would be about 80 to 100 industrial firms who will participate each year. You know, these are going to be some fairly heady, complex projects. And that the program, the person is funded as required under that bill by the electricity users, actual cost recovery. So that's our second proposed decision package.
If I may follow up, Madam Chair. And so if the move that I understand is on in this body, which would slow down the deregulation legislation that was passed last session, there's a bill, and I understand that would slow it down for 5 years. If that bill is actually passed through this body, then will your budget reflect the fact that hasn't started yet?
If Senate Bill 1149 is altered in that the public purpose charge is slowed or delayed or whatever, this is contingent on the existing bill.
Thank you.
Representative Nolan.
While we're on the sources fund page, a couple quick questions. Other funds, business energy tax credit. How does that become a source of funds for you?
We review applications for projects that for people who are coming in to get a business energy tax credit, and there is a very small administrative fee for those reviews.
Okay. Madam Chair, a couple more quick clarifications. Maybe this is part of your planned remarks, and if it is, I'll wait until you get to it. But I noticed that your manufactured home certification program shows a fairly dramatic increase from the 99.01 estimated to the 0103 proposed. Are you going to address why?
Thank you, Mr. Savage.
Let me explain. One of the programs that we have in place is a voluntary certification program that we put in place with the manufactured home industry of Oregon. And we certify homes that are highly energy efficient. And so we take a look at homes that are built to these standards. And they're built to the standards, I don't know if you have heard of the Super Good Sense homes.
Mm-hmm.
We're anticipating, as right now, the manufactured home industry is going through huge drops for a number of reasons, as you may have read out the paper, and we're anticipating that we're going to see more homes certified. Not only are we seeing fewer manufactured homes made, but also during this funding there has been a significant drop in the highly efficient ones that are being made. We anticipate both numbers to increase.
So if I might follow up, Madam Chair. This projected revenue and therefore balancing expense, I presume, is contingent on actual experience. So you're proposing $1 million.
Okay.
You don't see that increase in the number of homes that apply for this certification.
Madam Chair, Representative Nolan, it is not, just came to my mind. It is not just the number of homes that are certified, they're contingent. We're also receiving funds, I believe, from the Northwest Energy Efficient Alliance, that is also new funds that are coming in under this program to promote, again, the energy efficient design.
Good.
So that's what's new.
That's
so there's
great.
A component, part of the component of the increase is the funding from the Energy Efficiency Alliance.
That's great. And one final follow-up, Madam Chair. The other funds non-limited line in your small-scale energy loan program also seems to bounce around quite a bit over the years and is looking at a $13 million increase from 99.01 estimated to 0103 requested. I assume that that's a revolving fund, and so the amount of resources and expenditures that go in and out of that fund is contingent on repayment schedules of the loans that are outstanding?
Exactly, and also our payments of the bonds.
Okay.
So we issue under a small-scale energy loan programs to fund the loans, we issue general obligation bonds so that we have to make bond payments, and so it's reflecting sort of the dollars flowing to make bond payments, dollars flowing, also flowing out to make loan payments. And so they do, it does bump along year to year. One of the things that our bond payments, for example, are reduced from the upcoming bond and from this bond, in part because we have refunded some of the bonds at lower interest rates, so our payments are less.
Great. Thank you.
Let's proceed.
Okay. Cost cutting, one of the pieces that was asked for the presentations was cost cutting, and I'd like to talk briefly about our measures to cut costs this biennium. And we've taken several actions. One is we cut one administrative support position, saving $157,000 during this biennium. Second, we shared a staff person with the Oregon members of the Northwest Power Planning Council to work on Bonneville Power Administration issues that would affect both the state and region. And by doing so, that they did not have to fill a federally funded position, and then also then with the savings paid for about half of our staffer's position. We also saved an estimated $10,000 by electronically registering persons for a conference and providing for purchases for materials electronically, our first foray into e-commerce, which we plan to expand next biennium. And then for short-term workload increases, the office has been hiring contractors or temporary help, particularly during peak periods, and by doing so, we don't have to hire new staff. Administrative costs is another area that was asked for in your, overall administrative costs account for a little less than 9% of our operating budget. Those costs include the salary and related expenses for myself, my assistant, and my central service staff, with the exception of public information. It also includes state government service charges, such as from the Department of Administrative Service imposes the charges on all agencies. So we included that in our definition of administrative costs. I believe this estimate is overstated because we have a number of our central service staff who are also doing direct program work. For example, our receptionist answers many, many customer questions about our tax credit incentive programs and logs and tracks tax credits. Over the past biennia, several biennia, our administrative cost as defined, the way we've defined it as a share of budget, has been dropping. That kind of goes over very, sort of our cost. I guess I talked about our industrial conservation package. If I may, I'd like to talk about our other proposed enhancement package, and that's the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry. This package is can't remember the name of the enhancement package. Anyway, the 100, I believe. This requests $1.4 million in general fund limitation for OMSI. By way of background, let me give you some background, because this is actually goes back a way. In 1992, the office loaned OMSI $15.5 million. The loan went for the energy-saving features of the new museum, plus a part of construction cost, and the new museum cost $51 million. For the first 3 years of the loan, OMSI made full payments. Then it got into such dire financial straits that it could make no payments to us from January of 1996 through November of 1997. A mix of factors contributed to their financial problems. First, there was a $15.6 million cost overrun in building and financing the new museum. And that absorbed virtually all the funds that had been dedicated for an endowment, the earnings of which were to pay off our debt, went for a debt payment. So we lost, in a sense, they lost their source of funding to pay off the loan. Operating costs then grew more than expected, and gifts and donations grew more than expected. And then in February of 1996, the flood so damaged the building they had to shut it down for 4 months. OMSI operated in the red for 1996 and 1997. By July of 1997, they owed us $1.7 million in back loans, in addition to monthly loan payments of $92,000 that they weren't making. So they requested help from the 1997 legislature, which appropriated $1.5 million, and based on their financial progress, which was the criteria used. And I went before the e-board, I believe, 7 times that session to highlight their financial progress. The e-board released all of those funds. The 1999 legislature appropriated $1.425 million in general funds, and based on OMSI's continued financial progress, the recent e-board released all those funds. OMSI has made a substantial turnaround in the past 3 years. I'll only touch on a couple. They paid us $2 million from the sale of the old Washington Park site where OMSI had been. They also negotiated a dimes on the dollar payoff of a $4.8 million bank loan. They received $700,000 from the City of Portland and Metro, and they brought in the largest single donation in their history, $3.3 million from the Swigert Foundation. And since June of 1998, has paid us $112,500 per quarter out of operations. Today, with the infusions of the state dollars, they are current on their loan. Same time, it's going to be a ways for them to bring in sufficient revenues to pay its operating cost and to be able to make full loan payments, full debt payments to us. Well, that's kind of the OMSI situation.
If I may follow up, Madam Chair.
So you said right now they are current as far as their loan payments are concerned. And they have an expectation that the $1.4 million that's in the governor's budget will assist them in getting through the next 2 years. Have you had conversations with them about what happens if that money is not available in this budget?
Madam Chair, Representative Bowman, no, we have not.
Thank you.
Representative Krieger.
If I don't understand this right, they borrowed 15 point something from the state. Now the state's paying them money to pay the loan that they owe the state to start with. Am I mixed up somehow?
No.
No. Got it clear.
How did they get a business deal like that?
You have to be a non-profit to begin with.
Yeah, the proceeds of the payments have been directly going for loan payments. So the general fund is effectively going to OMSI for its loan payments.
It was a unique situation for a unique organization that provides a valuable service to the state of Oregon. I in no way by my question suggested that it wasn't appropriate that they did that. My suggestion is merely that with the tight budget that we have right now, everything's on the table. So I just didn't want them to have the expectation that it was automatic, because we're looking at every dollar of general fund that we have. And that opportunity may not be present this session. Thank you.
Representative Hayden, did you have a question?
Yes. Would it be possible for you to comment? Maybe you don't have the knowledge to comment, but WISTEC in Eugene just closed for lack of funding, and OMSI is receiving substantial financial support. Was there a difference in scale between the two institutions, why one got help and one didn't?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, I'm not aware of WISTEC.
Okay, well,
that answers that question.
Yeah, that answers my question. Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Questions or comments? Well, Representative Hanson.
Thank you. I was involved somewhat as part of the Multnomah County discussions on this when it first came up two sessions back. One of the differences here compared to a lot of the other cultural groups, when OMSI had its very, very serious financial problems, there was an outstanding loan of $15 million. It was backed by a museum that may have been worth $6 million at the most. So there was sort of the situation that the keys were on the table. Is it better to help subsidize the loan until they can get back on their feet, or foreclose on a $6 million property against a $15 million liability? So I think some of the other cultural institutions didn't have quite that type of motivation for the state to get involved.
Should have borrowed more money.
Yeah.
Please proceed.
That pretty much covers my presentation.
Okay. Thank you very much. That was very interesting. Let's move to Lisa Pearson from DAS and the Budget Management Division of DAS to go over the Governor's recommended budget.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee. My name is Lisa Pearson with the Department of Administrative Services, and you should have a document that looks like this in front of you. And I think, actually, we covered just about everything that's in this document, so I will be very fast. On page 2, there is a table that provides this committee with a summary information over several years as to what this budget has looked like, and that's essentially for your reference. On page 3, again, you can see that the vast majority of this budget is for other funds non-limited, which is essentially the loan program. On page 4, we actually start looking at the governor's recommended budget, which is a 10.7% decrease from the legislatively approved budget, but the majority of the change comes in the current service level. And the governor's recommended budget does add funding for the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry, adds an industrial conservation analyst to implement Senate Bill 1149. Otherwise, it maintains the current service level. On page 5, there's a graphical representation of the operations program unit in this budget. And the general fund that you see there really goes to OMSI, or Oregon Museum of Science and Industry. It doesn't get used for any kind of other operational activity. Page 6 shows the funding for the loan program unit. And it's all other funds, non-limited. It is the loan repayments and the bonding that has been discussed. Page 7 shows the breakout by the different kinds of expenditures for the total budget. Personal services are 6%. Non-limited debt service for those bonds is 37%. Special payments is 52% of the total budget. And combined, the non-limited debt service and those special payments just about make up the loan program. So again, you can see that the majority of this budget does go for the loan program. On page 8, we walk through how we got to where we're at today with the governor's recommended budget. And this is a typical process for any state agency that comes before you. Their emergency boards through April 2000 included distributions of emergency funds that were specially appropriated to the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry. In addition, there was a negotiated statewide salary plan adjustment that all state agencies received. And there were some federal grants that came through, so they needed additional limitation. The current service level budget adjustments include debt service and non-limited adjustments according to expected repayments of loans, debt service adjustments, refunding of the bonds, that kind of thing. It also includes standard personal services adjustments, including the merit increases that Mr. Savage mentioned earlier, but also including a full biennium's worth of those salary plan adjustments that were approved in the emergency board. And then standard inflation. There were no unusual inflationary aspects to this budget. On page 9, it summarizes the two policy packages that the governor recommends. The package 100 is that industrial conservation analyst. It is one position, one full-time FTE. And again, that's for implementing Senate Bill 1149. And then package 101 is the OMSI support that we just talked about. And there are no technical adjustments. And that concludes my presentation.
Questions or comments from the committee members? Senator Dukes.
I'm guessing it's page 2. The general fund line, which I'm assuming is OMSI, was that the current biennium, the request was for $1,699,000, and the legislature approved $950,000. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Dukes, the actuals line is from, and I think that the dates got cut off there, but it would be for the 1997-99 biennium. So this is what was approved for the 1997-99 biennium. And as you can see, it did go down. I might note that the legislatively approved column was only through April of 2000. So that was about two-thirds of the way through the distribution that's actually been made this biennium.
Okay, how much was actually approved for the current biennium then?
Madam Chair, Senator Dukes, $1,425,000, and that has been distributed at this point.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions? I think that concludes the budget presentation by the agency and by DAS for the Office of Energy. At this time, I'll ask for anyone that is here that wishes to give input, please come forward. For the record, please state your name.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Fred Hewitt. I live in Portland, Oregon. I'm an energy policy analyst and have been involved in energy issues in the legislature for quite a few years. And I'm pleased to hear the report from the Office of Energy and the questions that the committee presented. It was a very thorough presentation. And my message to you today is very simple. This is an agency that's really doing a good job. And I hope that the legislature will continue to support their mission over the next biennium. Excuse me. It's my recollection the last time I testified this committee was 1995. At that point, there was a proposal to change the department status of this office to what is now the Office of Energy. There were some who were even saying that the agency should be abolished, as Washington State was doing with its Washington State Energy Office. Fortunately, we did not do that. And although I was concerned at that time that the Office of Energy would lose some of its stature, some of the scope of its activities, that really hasn't happened. And I think the ensuing years have shown that Oregon chose a wiser course. So I hope that you will continue that. The energy conservation programs that John Savage mentioned are some of the ones that are the longest standing in the department, have a very good history, very well-run programs, and those are the kinds of things that indicate the effectiveness of our energy conservation policy. I always think of energy conservation as being sort of like a tax cut, but without the revenue implications. It helps businesses or consumers save money that they can then re-spend within the state, generates employment, and in fact probably is a net benefit to the state, no matter how you look at it. Now that we have another energy crisis, I think we're going to realize the value of that approach, and I hope that we will expand it rapidly because we really do need that in this state and in the region. In the policy area, I think it ought to be pointed out that the Office of Energy has become a very good partner with the Public Utility Commission on energy policy, the evolving energy policy that we now have with the restructuring bill under Senate Bill 1149 and other issues that are always out there. that did not used to be the case back in the 80s. I think that the PUC and the Office of Energy have become much better cooperative partners in developing that policy. And they're both agencies are very respected now, not just in this state, but throughout the region and the country for having done that. The background of that goes back well into the 70s, but obviously has now a pretty long history, over 20 years of planning by the Office of Energy that I think has really helped the state chart a course through a rather difficult transition as we've gone forward. And now, as obviously we go forward into this, whatever kind of era we have, given what's going on in California, I think we're really going to appreciate what we've done in the past. Finally, I want to mention that one of the things that distinguishes Oregon's approach is an open, publicly accessible commitment to planning. This, again, contrasts, I'm afraid, to the state of California, where they have a more closed process, and I'm somewhat thinking that that will cause a great deal of public concern about what their approach to the energy crisis of the moment is, and I hope that we will continue that as well. So again, very briefly, it's not very often that we get to stand up and say that agencies we've been, as I have been in the past, critical of, have come a long way over the last 20-some years and have really done a good job for the state, and I hope that they will continue to do so. If I may, I'd like to add one more comment. I really appreciated Senator Farioli's statement about Hanford. I thought that was the most concise, clear overview of what the situation is there that I've heard. And I would just mention that with Secretary Abraham coming to the state this week, I hope that our state will make clear to him that the cleanup at Hanford is absolutely of the highest importance to us, and hopefully that the groundwork that the Office of Energy has prepared in that area will really help that message get across. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Questions or comments from the commission or the committee? Thank you very much. We appreciate your input to us. Tomorrow we will take the LFO recommendation for this budget, and it's the chair's intention to pass this budget out tomorrow. So if the committee members could make every effort to be here, that would be fabulous. If there is no more business to come before this committee, I will adjourn until tomorrow at 1 o'clock.